Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Grace Wan. Coming up, political scientist Dr. Terry Givens joins us to talk about how we can start to repair post-election political and racial divides by practicing radical empathy. But first, on the pandemic front, it feels like March all over again. COVID cases are spiking throughout the region, and over the weekend, San Francisco and San Mateo counties regressed to the purple tier, which is triggering a series of new restrictions. Starting tonight, San Francisco and San Mateo join most of the Bay Area in imposing a 10 p.m. to 5 a.m. curfew. Joining us to break down the latest developments, we have our COVID dream team. I'm joined by Erin Alday, the health reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. Welcome back, Erin.
Hi, thanks for having me again.
Yeah. And we have Dr. Peter Chin-Hong. He's an infectious disease specialist at UCSF. Welcome back, Peter.
Thanks for having me on, Grace.
Well, guys, it feels like this is Groundhog Day, but maybe it's the darkness before the dawn. Erin, San Francisco and San Mateo counties are now back in the purple tier. That's California's most restrictive reopening tier. What happened?
Well, you know, to be honest, nobody was really surprised by this. I shouldn't say nobody, but they were anticipating this for a long time. I mean, if you looked at the map, you could see that, you know, the entire region was basically purple. These were kind of the holdouts. Now we still have Marin County is actually not in purple yet, and they're actually looking pretty good. That's kind of the little bright spot in all of this. But I would say that, you know, San Francisco had been sort of saying, prepping people for a good week that they were headed in that direction. And it's just, you know, it's what we're seeing all over, frankly, the country. These cases are just really spiraling, and we keep kind of trying to shut things down and sort of get things back under control, and we're just not really making a lot of progress there. And of course, you know, with the Thanksgiving holiday and you know, all our concerns we have about the winter, I think we're just running out of time, frankly, to get things under control. So that's why we're seeing these sort of increasingly restrictive measures coming up.
And can you tell us or remind us, what does it mean to have a 10 p.m. to 5 a.m. curfew? What can we do and what can't we do?
Well, it's kind of interesting. People sort of laugh about it a little bit because there wasn't a lot you could do after 10 o'clock anyway. So, I mean, mostly it's just like outdoor dining is no longer allowed. It's, you know, you can still go grocery shopping after 10 o'clock. You can still, you know, take your dog to the vet for an emergency if you need to. You can still take your dog for a walk. You can still exercise. So, I mean, most things that are deemed, you know, if you think it's essential, if this is something that you need to do, then that still is fine. In fact, you can go and pick up your restaurant takeout after 10 o'clock if you want to. It's mostly just discouraging people from any sort of scenario where they might gather with others that is after 10 o'clock no longer allowed. But like I said, you know, there weren't really many options for people to do that anyway. So speaking of somebody who's been in Alameda County and living under the curfew for a while, I mostly forget that it's a thing.
I can't even remember when I was last out at 10 o'clock. So
right,
that's,
exactly. Yeah.
Well, today, this afternoon, Governor Newsom also said that California may need to have a new stay-at-home order. What is that all about?
Yeah, I think that that was interesting. It's again, it's not super surprising. I think given the direction, again, that we're seeing the numbers and especially the hospital numbers, we're seeing really kind of some frightening hospital numbers that I'm sure Peter will talk about later. But, you know, we're going to need to take, as the governor said today, probably some pretty drastic action. He didn't really telegraph a lot of what that might look like. From my perspective, I think we can maybe look at Santa Clara County and Los Angeles County, both of which have instituted restrictions beyond what the state has already mandated. So, you know, Los Angeles County, for example, has ended all outdoor dining. So there's no, you know, restaurant dining at all. You can get carry out, you can get delivery, but that's it. There's no dining at a restaurant anymore. Santa Clara County has done really extreme restrictions on retail and sort of any sort of indoor activity. Of course, they you know, are forbidding any sort of contact sports. So that's why we're not going to be having any football down there. So I suspect we're going to see some more sort of targeted orders like that, that are probably at the end of the day going to feel pretty similar to what we were dealing with back in the spring with the initial kind of blanket stay-at-home order.
Well, and Peter, let's talk about the hospitals. How are they faring right now? What does it look like at the UCSF and other Bay Area medical centers?
Well, I'm really pessimistic. Numbers have probably gone up about 2.5 times what they were a month ago in terms of hospitalizations. And you know, it's not that people are not going to the ICU because a fair number of folks are in the ICU. And if UCSF is a microcosm of what's going on in the county and in the Bay Area, it's frightening.
Are you saying that there are not enough ICU beds?
Right now they are. But I'm not really sure when we'll reach the tipping point because, you know, we probably won't see the cases reflected from Thanksgiving travel for about 2 weeks. And then an additional 2 weeks or so would be where you see people start trickling into hospitals. If you look at what happened in Memorial Day, I think our spike in hospitalizations really went from 4 to 8 weeks after Memorial Day. So basically, you know, it's a really somber time and we're all sort of bracing ourselves.
What are the hospitals doing to prepare? I mean, it seems that everyone's kind of bracing for that post-Thanksgiving wave. Can you tell us a little bit about what's happening in your hospital and hospitals that you're seeing?
So I think in general, we've used the preparation we did for the surge and tipping point that never happened in early March. So they included, we still have that tent for overflow. We have Mount Zion, which is an additional hospital that we retrofitted in time for having additional beds open. So that's still up and running. We've stockpiled over the last few months PPE, and we've stockpiled drugs like remdesivir. So, you know, during the time of plenty when there wasn't a lot going on, we use our allocation and kept it in the pharmacy. So all of that is really leading to sort of building the stores for the, you know, having that extra artillery in the toolkit. But what we can't prepare for is when people and house staff and hospital providers get sick themselves.
Right. And in the last couple of months, we've heard about new therapies. You've mentioned remdesivir. But the president himself received something called Regeneron. And Ben Carson, his HUD secretary, said that he also received that and felt that it was life-saving to him. Is that a therapy that will be available to people now?
Yes, it is available. We've purchased, so these are monoclonal antibody cocktails. We've been allocated, so different hospitals get allocated a certain amount, but not everybody has taken all their allocation. And that gives you an indication that it's not quite that straightforward to administer. You have to be in a very tight window period, which is within 3 days after diagnosis, not be sick enough to be in the hospital, but sort of be in the nether, sort of not too well, not too sick category. It also requires an outpatient facility to infuse a drug. And of course, in COVID times, it's not as easy because you have to make sure you have enough space and personnel to administer the drug, which takes an hour. And then you have to wait an hour after that to make sure people are doing okay. So at UCSF, for example, despite having a huge hospital, we probably only have the capacity to give 1 to 2 people a drug per day in the outpatient setting in this fashion.
Wow. Well, I think San Francisco and the Bay Area generally has done a lot of good work in trying to get the public message out about the spread, how contagious it is. And yet you hear when you're walking through the street or you're talking among friends or acquaintances, people are like, well, it's not that bad. And my kid had it and he didn't get that sick. So, you know, it's not as bad as you think it is. And I think that the public health element is fighting against that and looking at how many people left for Thanksgiving trips and seeing how busy Phoenix Airport is. And I think, Peter, you had mentioned to our producer about there's a backup of 20 miles for people leaving Las Vegas to get back into L.A. because they were there for Thanksgiving. How are you guys handling that? And as doctors, it must be so frustrating to try to send out this message and people just don't seem to be listening.
It's really frustrating, but understandable. You know, if you are in your circle and you know that, you know, the kid in the soccer team got it and nothing happened, or, you know, maybe that other kid who was in, you know, that practice session with basketball got it, but nothing happened. You know, it really speaks to that power of anecdote. And, you know, in the hospital, of course, we're seeing the sickest of the sick as well. And what's invisible, I think, to the general public's eyes is really the disproportionate impact on specific populations, particularly the elderly. You know, we're still seeing essential workers coming down. That with COVID, it hasn't gone away. And the more widespread it gets, it could be your grandmom or your aunt next or your parents. So I think it's really tough to do prevention. Prevention is not sexy. It's, you know, when you get something bad, you treat it. And that's really what's etched into people's minds usually.
Right. And Aaron, tell us a little bit about what testing capacity in the Bay Area looks like. Are people able to quickly get tested or is it a long wait?
That's an interesting question. I would say we're hearing anecdotally that people are having to wait, or they're having a hard time making appointments for specific purposes. So it's kind of a complicated picture. My understanding is if you are, you know, somebody who has symptoms, who has a known exposure, and if you're an essential worker, that, you know, there are plenty of testing resources available to you, either through public testing clinics or private insurance providers. Where we're sort of running into some barriers are people who, you know, may have very legitimate reasons for getting tested. You know, maybe they just had a sort of secondary exposure, or they did something that was a little bit risky and they're worried about it. You know, plenty of people who are returning from traveling for Thanksgiving, maybe they had to, maybe they were seeing a relative who this was their last Thanksgiving, or I don't know, I'm not going to judge, but like, you know, they may be coming back and feel like they need to be tested to be safe. Those are the folks that anecdotally, again, I'm hearing are having a hard time scheduling appointments. So they will go and try to, you know, they can't get it through their private provider. If they go to a public site, they find that appointments are, you know, not available for a week or two out. So there's definitely some issues there. All that being said, you know, the state is doing more testing than ever before. Our local counties have actually some of the higher testing rates. In, you know, compared to a lot of other counties in the country. And our turnaround time on results is actually in pretty good shape. It's taking about a day or two for almost all tests now to come back. So, you know, I think it's just sort of hit and miss, and it's kind of to be expected that with this much virus kind of out there now and people really get, you know, taking to heart that public health message of, you know, concern, that more people want to get tested, and that is going to strain our resources to a degree.
Mm-hmm. And Peter, tell us, if you believe that you've been exposed to the coronavirus, at what point should you try to get tested? Is it immediately, 3 days later, 5 days later?
It sounds like a great multiple choice question for a study, for test. But the sweetest spot is really 7 days, and you do the test, and the test is negative. That is probably the best balance between not going stir crazy and waiting 2 weeks. If the earliest you can be a truly positive if you were exposed is day 3 to 4. But really by day 7, most people are going to, who have it, will declare themselves on the test. So that's kind of where I think most guidelines are going to settle. I think eventually the 14-day thing will be outdated because people will have access to testing to sort of like shorten that period of time, because it seems weird that if you get COVID, you're kind of scot-free at 10 days, which itself is going to be shortened probably. But if you didn't even have COVID and you were suspected or you were in contact, you have to wait 2 weeks.
Good advice from our doctor. Well, California is expected to get 327,000 doses of the Pfizer vaccine in December. I think Gavin Newsom announced that this afternoon as well. They're largely going to healthcare workers, but there are 2.4 million healthcare workers in the state. So any idea of who's going to get it first, Aaron Alday?
Ask me that question. I actually don't think that the state has said that yet. I think they're still figuring that out. My understanding is that we would be getting more information about that probably maybe later this week. I mean, surely if we're going to get it, you know, in December, then we better find out soon who is going to get those. But as you, I mean, just do the raw numbers there. I mean, that's not very many people out of the total number of healthcare workers. I think you can probably speculate that it's going to be people who are working with, you know, COVID positive patients, people who are really kind of, you know, healthcare workers who are in those settings that are most likely to be kind of interacting with people who have COVID-19 or who are maybe working with very vulnerable populations. But Peter probably has more thoughts on that than I do.
Yeah, Peter, what's your advice on if you were telling Gavin Newsom where to allocate those vaccines, where would they go?
Well, first of all, I'm glad you asked Erin the question. So I can always, she always primes me, and then I can get some more time to think about it. But really, I think that it's the state response is a little bit hasn't been made public yet. But institutionally, we've been, you know, a group of folks have been meeting in various institutions to come up with guidelines. And it's really what Erin said, you know, it's based on what's your likelihood of exposure, how long, how many patients you're seeing like that, and regardless of seniority or status, et cetera. So think of the setting rather than the what rank you have. So emergency room, ICU, so nurses, physicians, occupational therapists, social workers, physical therapists, people who do the testing, those would be prioritized, pulmonologists, infectious disease doctors. And then you think about going off from there to other people who work in the hospital and so on. So people are using ethics and content experts to try to come up with these numbers because it's really, really tough otherwise.
Well, I think the next hurdle that we'll be facing is, you know, how to roll out the vaccine, but also convincing people that it's safe to take and kind of getting them ready to think about what will be required of them to take it. It as I understand it, it's two jabs, at least with the Pfizer vaccine. Is that the same with all of them, Peter?
Yes. In general, it's the same with all of them. There is some talk that J&J was thinking about having a one dose vaccine, but in for all intents and purposes, it's going to be two shots for the best efficacy. And you're right. I mean, you can get one shot, but then who's to say that you're going to get the second shot, you know, afterwards?
Right. So it's trying to remind people it's not just one, but it's two shots. And as many people as we can try to get it, we need to have them vaccinated. What's the earliest you think, Peter, that we'll be seeing kind of widespread vaccination of the population? Is that spring 2021?
So I'm thinking late spring, early summer right now for most of the population to get immunized. Of course, those over 65 and with comorbid conditions, heart disease, lung disease, people who live in congregate settings like nursing home residents, people who work in prisons, for example, would be, and teachers would probably get it first. And then by late spring, early summer, most of the rest of the population would have vaccine available. With that said, if more and more companies produce product, that timeline could be shifted forward.
Well, last question, Erin. As we go into the holidays and we've seen what happened at Thanksgiving, what, if anything, are officials trying to do to encourage people to stay home for the holidays?
Oh, man, that's a great question. I think we're just going to keep getting this kind of same message hammered home. I do suspect that if we do see, you know, this surge in cases that we're worried about, that we're anticipating from Thanksgiving, which we'll know about in a week or two, you know, and if that then translates to our hospitals really picking up, I mean, we may just be under another, you know, pretty restrictive stay home order that essentially makes those decisions for us. It's hard to say kind of what you can do in terms of stopping people from gathering in their own homes, right? So like if people get together for the holidays, there's, you know, nobody's going to enforce that. Nobody's going to have cops, you know, banging down people's doors on Christmas Eve. And breaking up, you know, parties. So I think it's just going to be a lot of messaging. And like I said, I think we are going to see more restrictions and just a lot of messaging to really, really take care. Hopefully it doesn't come to, you know, we will see by example of our ICUs being overwhelmed in the next couple of weeks. And, you know, that's, I hope that that's not what it's going to take to get people to kind of do what they should. But, you know, that may be what we're looking at.
Well, it's going to be a critical few weeks and maybe time to order that really tiny turkey for your holiday dinner, which you might be just having by yourself. Cornish hen, exactly. I want to thank Erin Alday, a health reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle, and Dr. Peter Chin Hong, an infectious disease specialist at UCSF, always giving us great advice. Thanks, Erin and Peter.
Thanks
so much. Yeah.
Thanks, Peter.
Thanks, Erin.
Coming up, we're going to be talking with political scientist and author Terry Givens about her forthcoming book, Radical Empathy, Finding a Path to Bridging the Racial Divide. Stay tuned. Welcome back to City Visions. I'm Grace Wan. It's been a year. We're still dealing with a pandemic that's claimed over 260,000 American lives. We're just starting to pick up the pieces after the most rancorous presidential election in recent history. And we're reeling after a series of police killings of innocent black people, which again laid bare the institutional racism that's endemic in our society. So how do we truly begin to heal our profound divides? For political scientist Terry Givens, the answer lies in radical empathy, the idea that we've got to not only understand one another's lives and pain, but also appreciate the origins of our biases before we can start bridging differences. Terry Givens is the CEO and founder of Brighter Higher Ed, a leadership training consulting practice, and the author of the forthcoming book, Radical Empathy, Finding a Path to Bridging Racial Divides. She was formerly a professor and vice provost at University of Texas at Austin, and provost of Menlo College. Welcome, Terry Givens.
Thanks so much for having me, Grace.
Well, we're delighted to talk to you. I loved reading your book. So let's just start out. What is radical empathy, and how is that different from plain old empathy?
Well, you know, I started off thinking about the fact that, you know, I'm a pretty empathic person, and, you know, I'd like to think that I can, you know, put myself in other people's shoes and understand their experiences. But I realized, you know, we can't just count on empathy to get us to the next steps we need to go to in terms of bridging our racial divides. And so I thought about it a lot, and I said, we really need radical empathy, which is taking a step past empathy to taking action and creating change. And that in the process of creating change, we are practicing empathy as well. Because I think that, you know, we can have empathy, but you really have to practice empathy on a regular basis in order to really create change.
And what does it mean to practice empathy? I mean, I feel sorry for people when I see them in tough straits, but how can I practice that empathy?
Well, first, you have to start practicing empathy for yourself. So one of the things I had to really focus in on when I, you know, one of the reasons I actually started this book is because I felt like there were some issues in my, you know, family life and so on that I really just didn't have a handle on that were related to race. And so I said, you know, it was time for me to take a deep dive. And so for me, that first step was, you know, first of all, I talk about the six steps of radical empathy. And the first is a willingness to be vulnerable. And so for me, that willingness to be vulnerable meant that I had to really take a step back and look at my own life and the way I was raised and all of these different aspects of my life and how I had been impacted by things like structural racism and internalized oppression. And so for me, that whole idea of practicing empathy started with myself. And once I had a better handle on my own experiences with these issues, I could then turn around and, you know, basically open myself to the experiences of others.
Well, in that idea of making yourself vulnerable, and it sounds like being kinder to yourself, mm-hmm. Was that just doing a lot of reading? Was that working with a counselor? How did you get to that place?
All of the above.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of Oprah involved. There must be some Oprah there.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Oprah's great for this stuff. But, you know, I mean, and I've, you know, I have to be honest. I used to watch Oprah, the Oprah show, and read all
Who
books.
Hasn't?
All
Who hasn't? Who hasn't,
Terry? I know. But you know, it for me, it was really, I felt like I'd done a lot of that kind of external work. I, you know, talked to counselors and so on, but it was, you know, like I said, it was really getting vulnerable. And like I said, looking back at, you know, the way I was raised. So I grew up in Spokane, Washington, which is, you know, at the time was less than 1% Black. But the interesting thing is my parents, you know, we didn't really, my dad was in the military and we didn't really interact a lot with other Black people. And so I just felt this, you know, I felt like I was kind of angry with my parents for the way we'd been raised and that we didn't really have those connections to the Black community in Spokane or even to a certain extent to some of our relatives. And so, you know, I started working with that anger I had in myself and tried to understand my parents, first of all, understand myself and then my parents and the choices that they made. And part of that meant going back and studying history. And I'm the family genealogist. So I started digging through our family history and trying to understand what choices my parents made. But, you know, one of the there's two books that had a profound impact on me. One was Isabel Wilkerson's The Warmth of Other Suns.
Mm.
And the reason for that one was because she actually had the story of somebody from Louisiana who went to Los Angeles. And that was my mother's story.
Oh.
You know, she went from Louisiana to Los Angeles. And so that helped me get a better understanding of, you know, the choices she made. And you know, that was all part of the Great Migration. And then the other one was Yagi Yassi's Homegoing.
Oh, and another good book.
Amazing book. That was the first time I read a book that left me feeling like I actually had a connection to Africa.
Wow.
And, you know, it was just really an amazing book. And so, you know, I was really trying to get in touch with what it meant for me to be Black and, you know, to understand what it meant to my parents to be Black and the time, you know, growing up in the 1960s and 70s. And so it was really a process for me of, you know, besides the counseling and the Oprah, you know, of understanding our history and looking pretty, you know, I've been able to do a lot of work on our genealogy and understanding where my grandparents came from and so on.
Well, and I think when you were talking about those steps to get to radical empathy, so you've made yourself vulnerable, you really understand who you are. And I think that second step that you mentioned is kind of becoming grounded in who you are.
Yes.
And it sounds like that kind of spelunking through your genealogy really helped you get there.
Absolutely. And, you know, I call my 20s my years of cognitive dissonance.
I think that's for everybody.
It's true. When my editor was reading the book and I was talking about things like internalized depression and you know, imposter syndrome, my editor was like, well, that's just, you know, especially women, you know, we all go through that.
Right.
And so I completely agree with that. But becoming grounded in who you are, to me, you know, by the time I got to the end of my 20s, around the time you know I met my current, well, we'd already met, but I was dating my current husband, you know, I feel like that's the time period where I feel like things came together and I really started to understand and become grounded in who I am and more comfortable with you know, what it means to be Black in today's society when you, you know, you grew up in a place that didn't have a lot of Black people.
Right, right. Oh, and then what's the next? I mean, there's six steps. So after you become grounded, then what do you need to do?
So step number three is opening yourself to the experiences of others. And that's where this bridging divides comes in. So, you know, I felt, it's funny because I always tell people, you know, when you're falling in love and so on, you know, the reason I feel like I knew my husband was the right person for me is, you know, he made me a better person. And, you know, and we, you know, we always, you know, I always felt like I could be who I am with him. Mm. And so this idea of opening yourself to the experience of others is similar. When you're, you know, when you're with people who, you know, really accept you for who you are and, you know, really are understanding of who you are, you know, that's a gift. And so opening yourself to the experience of others and really listening to who they are and because you understand yourself, you can understand them. And, you know, I always say, because I could love myself, I could love my husband.
<You know? laughs> So. That's good ingredients for a good marriage.
Yes, indeed. But I take that to, you know, other aspects of my life. And, you know, but the other component of that is you don't have to like people to necessarily to open yourself to the experience of them. I've been talking to a lot of friends about this after the election, and they're really, you know, they feel like certain people, well, I just can't, you know, that doesn't mean you can't understand them or try, you know, and I've done a lot of work on the radical right. You know, a lot of my research was around that and the voters of people who vote for the radical right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the things I say is, look, I don't necessarily have to like somebody in order to understand them and to open myself up to their experiences. And so, you know, I think it's important that we do a lot of reading and understand this, you know, to a certain extent, it's understanding the society we live in. So, you know, when my neighbors with their Black Lives Matter signs come and say, well, what can I do? I'm like, well, first of all, look around your community,
mm-hmm.
you know, look at where you live. Do you understand why, you know, the demographics in your community are the way they are?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I happen to live in Menlo Park, California, and, you know, I can look around my neighborhood and there's some people of color there, but, you know, it's not a lot. And, you know, it's something that we need to understand. Why did it end up this way? You know, there's lots of books that talk about, you know, the demographics and redlining and all of that. And, you know, one of the reasons we have to be willing to, you know, and look at the historical factors is because that's why we have the structural racism that we have today. And then you can also understand why, you know, people live in certain neighborhoods and so on, and why we have the policing structures that we have. And so this idea of practicing empathy comes out of that, you know, that idea of opening yourself to the experiences of others, but right. that takes an ongoing action to actually practice that empathy.
It's not easy. Well, I want to go back to that, but first, this is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco. We're talking to Bay Area author and political scientist Terry Givens about her forthcoming book, Radical Empathy, Finding a Path to Bridging the Racial Divides. Have you split from friends or family members over racial or political issues? Are you ready to reconcile? Give us a call at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or send us an email to cityvisions@kalw.org with any questions or comments. So I wanted to go back to, I think it's very freeing, actually, Terry, to say, to open yourself up to the experience of others, you don't have to like them. You just have to be open to their experience. And it makes me think about something that I've read a lot post-election, which is after 2016, the media did a deep dive on trying to understand the Trump voter, who they were, what they stood for, why they voted for Trump in the first place. And that, you know, we've seen hillbilly elegy and all of that. And now, post-election, with the Biden-Harris win being certified state after state after state, there's not a lot of, let's try to understand the Biden voter. And right. I've been reading, you know, Biden voters saying, like, how come nobody's trying to understand us? Like, why can't we have our day in the sun? And what do you say to that?
Well, I think there's, you know, I think part of the reason for that is I think the media thinks, well, it's easy to understand a Harris-Biden voter, and maybe it's not so easy to understand a Trump voter. I mean, I think the media is coming at it from the perspective of, well, you know, why would somebody vote for Donald Trump?
Right.
The reality is, you know, it's interesting because, you know, I'm always reading about these topics. And I think one of the things we're missing out on here is that Ashley Jardina has written a book about white identity politics. And I think one of the things that people aren't understanding is that there's a whole group of people out there who are, you know, they identified with the message that Donald Trump was giving. And so we have this, I think, you know, the media see the norm as, oh, you know, we're open and, you know, to diversity and, you know, all of these other things. And you know, they don't think about people who see that white privilege is something they want to hang on to.
Yeah. And you actually nicely put it. You say, like, white supremacy or the white structure that we live in is kind of the ocean, and yes. we're just fishes swimming in it.
Yes, exactly. So we don't see, I had to deal with this personally myself because, you know, I that's why I talk about internalized oppression, because, you know, even for an African-American, you know, in the society, we are in the sea of white supremacy. And so a lot of our own actions are driven by this ideal that, you know, the norm in our society is whiteness, and that we, you know, just have to be, you know, we have to move ourselves to become a part of that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and in academia, I felt that a lot. You know, you have to jump through the hoops, you have to do things a certain way, you know, you have to dress a certain way, you have to talk a certain way. And, you know, once I find, you know, like I said, you know, I got to through my years of cognitive dissonance, and I realized, wow, I can just be myself.
Right. Right. Well, and then you talk about opening yourself up to experiences of others and then practicing, not just feeling, but practicing mm-hmm. that empathy. And I just want to be clear. I mean, when you say practicing empathy, does that mean that I have to be empathetic to everyone, even if I don't like them?
Not necessarily. I mean, practice, trust me, I mean, there's just going to be situations in your life when, you know, you're not going to, and I know there are times when I just have a hard time practicing empathy. It's more something you want to do. You know, so like in your workplace, or, you know, I'm an academic, so, you know, in school, and, you know, I really, as a professor, I have always tried really hard to have empathy for my students and for my colleagues. And, you know, I think, you know, more generally, you can try to have empathy for a group that is experiencing certain types of issues that you may not be familiar with. And that's kind of the where it comes to bridging these divides, is that you can, instead of saying, you know, every individual you have to practice empathy with, you can think about it in terms of practicing empathy for a group of people who may be experiencing something that you have not experienced. And so the idea is you put yourself in the shoes of somebody from that group, not necessarily a specific person, and try to understand what are they experiencing. So, you know, I'm hoping that people, you know, if they are trying to understand me, will look at the fact, hey, I need to take a few minutes and listen to Terry. She grew up, you know, she didn't grow up in a typical, you know, Black neighborhood or, you know, and so I need to understand that aspect of her. And, you know, there are people who, you know, may feel deprived because, you know, they grew up poor and struggling. And so they don't necessarily understand why people would say they have white privilege.
Mm-hmm. But you're, I mean, just to be clear, we're not asking people who have been harmed by oppressive systems or everyday racism to start practicing like radical empathy towards a white supremacist, right?
Oh, gosh, no. Okay. No. That's why I talk. So, you know, the next step after practicing empathy is taking action. And, mm-hmm. you know, the critical point here is that we all want to take action as much as possible to change these structures. You know, hopefully by practicing radical empathy, you're going to understand that these structures we live in, the sea of white supremacy isn't the ideal where we want to be. I mean, it's hurt. We're all hurt by internalized oppression. We're all hurt by, structural racism. I mean, there's so many studies out there that talk about the fact that if we were more egalitarian, if people weren't discriminated against, I mean, think of all the people who could be, you know, more self-actualized and be productive parts of society if we had a better approach to things like breaking down these structures we've put in place. And frankly, that go back hundreds of years.
Well, in putting that into the lens of race, I mean, something that you said in the book that was I found very profound is that, and it came up in the election, I think Biden said this, many other people said it, is like the Black voter keeps coming back and back to kind of save democracy. And you say their blood is in the soil of this country. They have no home country to return to. And that like Black women are kind of the perfecters of democracy, even though democracy hasn't always been good to them. And I think is that an example of a group that's not only practiced empathy but took action by voting to make democracy better?
Absolutely. I mean, it's interesting because I've been thinking about this a lot because I'm watching my friends talk about whether they can reach out to their families and so on. And I think about the fact that think of African Americans, particularly African American women, and the fact that over and over and over again, we come back and support this country and support democracy, despite the fact that we have been harmed. Mm-hmm. And so if we can do this, then I think the rest of the country can do this. right. You know, it's like we have been fighting for, you know, this, you know, for hundreds of years. And, you know, we still come back. We still believe in this country. And so to me, it's like, look at us as an example, you know, I mean, I could spend the rest of my life angry about the way I've been treated by this society. I mean, I have to be honest. I feel like I've been privileged. I'm well educated and so on. But, you know, there are some instances where I talk about this in the book where I wasn't treated fairly or, you know, I have to worry about my children, my two boys. But rather than going around feeling angry all the time, we try to change things. And that's what radical empathy is about. Because, you know, there's the practicing empathy, but there's also taking action and then creating change and building trust. And, you know, building trust is so critical because that's where I reach out to my friend, my white friends in particular. And I say, look, we have to create these systems of trust so that we can create that change that is going to break down structural racism.
Well, I mean, you can bookend our conversation, Oprah on one end and Stacey Abrams on the other, right?
Yes,
I mean, there's
exactly.
Somebody who has created change and built trust across racial and political lines by just saying something simple. And Stacey Abrams is the former politician, and she is a politician in Georgia who's Georgia, who's created a get out the vote campaign. But she's really built trust to encourage people to get out that vote. Mm-hmm. Do you think that creating change and building trust, that's the final element of radical empathy. Is that the hardest part?
Absolutely. Because, you know, one of the things, and I've been doing some workshops based on the book, and one of the things I find interesting is, you know, a lot of the work we've done around diversity, equity, and inclusion just hasn't led to a lot of change. You know, if you look here at Silicon Valley, you know, it's still hard for women and minorities to get into, you know, leadership positions or even jobs in Silicon Valley. And our education system is still not aligned to the point where, you know, children are getting, especially children from minority backgrounds, are getting the right education. So there's so many things that we still have to fix. And so creating change is very difficult. But, you know, I have to say that, you know, you look at the African-American community in particular, and we have been so persistent about trying to create this change. And so, you know, really this book is reaching out to, you know, particularly my white, you know, with the white community and saying, look, help us, be allies, support us in creating this change because we're all going to benefit.
Well, it's such a good book and something that people should read before the holidays, even if you're not getting together in person with family or friends. It's a good way to have a conversation even over Zoom to kind of get into that structure of radical empathy. And the nice part about the book, it serves as a little bit of a workbook as well. It asks questions at the end of each chapter, which I thought was real helpful. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Terry Givens. It was a pleasure to speak with you. When and where can readers find your book?
So it is available for pre-order right now on Amazon or from Policy Press, which is my publisher. And so I encourage people, you know, get by it for the holidays. and we'll be doing some book launch events after the first of the year as well.
Well, that's great. Well, thank you very much. That was Terry Givens, the author of Radical Empathy. And as she said, her book is available for pre-order online. Thanks so much, Terry.
Thank you.
Speaking of empathy, tomorrow is Giving Tuesday, and in challenging times like these, Giving Tuesday reminds us to take a moment and think about the things we're grateful for, like family or a good meal, or listening to a well-told story here on KALW. We've been by your side all year, serving you and our community with thorough, dedicated news, alongside moments of gratitude that offer perspective. For Giving Tuesday, which again is tomorrow, please consider showing your gratitude by donating to this station. Call 1-800-525-9917 or go to klw.org. Thanks so much. And up next, holiday book recommendations from local writer Vanessa Waugh and San Francisco Chronicle columnist Barbara Lane. Welcome back to City Visions. This is Grace Wan. 2020 has been an incredibly challenging year, and many of us have turned to books for an explanation of these turbulent times or for an escape. Book sales have reflected American efforts to make sense of the pandemic, political turmoil, and racial injustice. Books from previous years have resurfaced on bestseller lists like Ibram Kendi's How to Be an Anti-Racist and Robin DiAngelo's White Fragility. They've also been joined by new books like Mary Trump's Too Much and Never Enough, and Isabel Wilkerson's Cast. Although top 10 lists were just released and the National Book Award and Booker Prize winners were announced this month, tonight we're talking about your favorites with our guests, Vanessa Waugh. She's a columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle and the award-winning best-selling author of the novel A River of Stars and the short story collection entitled Deceit and Other Possibilities. Welcome back, Vanessa.
Thanks for having me on.
Great. And we also have Barbara Lane. She's the book columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle and the director of events for Copperfield Books. Welcome, Barbara.
Thanks, Grace. Happy to be here.
Well, I love a good book. So I think I wanted to start by asking, what books have you turned to this year, Vanessa?
The ones that I keep recommending over and over include Interior Chinatown by Charles Yu, which just won the National Book Award. And also Yoko Ogawa's Memory Police, and She Votes, by local author Bridget Quinn. I could talk up each of those books, but, this is just to start us off.
Well, let's start with the first one, Interior Chinatown. What's that book about?
So, it's a novel told in the form of a screenplay, and it's about, racial archetypes, about where, Asian Americans fit in sort of the black-white binary, and in it, the character is trying to work his way up from being like number five, right-hand man to being kung fu guy on this cop show. It's very funny. It's very funny, and I was so glad to see it win the National Book Award.
And is he a first-time author, or is this something? Has he been around for a long time?
I think he's written a couple novels, and also he also writes for television. So I think that is evidence in sort of like his ability to be able to subvert the stereotypes and play with it in really interesting ways.
Well, I want to go into some of your other books, but let's bring Barbara into the conversation. Barbara, what are you recommending to friends right now?
Well, right now, the thing I just finished yesterday and I absolutely adored was Kevin Barry's Night Boat to Tangier, which is a book about something I never thought I would be interested in, which is two aging Irish gangsters sitting in a court in Spain waiting for one of their long-lost daughters to show up en route to Tangier. Kevin Barry is just such a great writer. And his pacing, his prose, his sense of humor. I've written a column recently about the gift that people from Ireland who write seem to have. And I know that's painting with a broad brush, but this book is fabulous. But backing up to this year, as we all know, it's been a bizarre, sad, challenging, weird, whatever adjective you want to throw at the year. And when the pandemic first started, I was so crazy and scattered, I couldn't focus on anything. And I'm a longtime mindfulness practitioner, and I found that books by, for example, Jack Kornfield, Path with a Heart, were the only things I could read because I just needed to settle down. I just couldn't operate as normal. So that was really important for me in the beginning, just to ground me. And then you referred to George Floyd. So I did some prescriptive reading for myself around that. Jessamyn Ward's Men We Reaped is a book I just adored. And you mentioned Ibram Kendi, How to Be an Anti-Racist. I also loved his book Stamped, A History of Racism in America, which was just so eye-opening to me, sort of the roots of the systematic racism we have in this country. I have a lot more, but I don't want to dominate.
This is the time of year where recommendations are so important. And I know I'm a big reader, but I almost found my brain was so scattered to kind of what you were saying, Barbara, that it was hard to concentrate and read without checking my phone to see what the latest COVID number was or what the last thing happened in the election was. So I think the Jack Kornfield books are kind of a nice recommendation if you're trying to quiet the mind. He's like a famous mindfulness meditation teacher, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. And he's right here at our very own Spirit Rock. We're lucky to have him.
Well, that's great. And so, Vanessa, you had two other recommendations. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the second one?
Sure. Although I did want to sort of chime in. Speaking of books in terms of that have been around but faced new popularity, I wanted to also recommend Octavia Butler's Parable of the Sower and Parable of the Talents. She wrote these books in the 90s, and then they were incredibly prescient in terms of predicting the apocalypse of all kinds, late stage capitalism, years after her death, she hit the New York Times bestseller list in September. So I think there really is sort of a cultural moment in terms of this really badass African-American teen narrator and sort of the path she carves out for herself and her her found family, which, and also like she talks about, making acorn bread. And during the pandemic, I've been foraging. So the book resonated in all these ways. Apparently, our go bags can't just have our wind-up radios. We need to be carrying seeds, and because who knows what kind of life we need to carve out for ourselves. But the other books I talked about, I think I mentioned Yoko Ogawa's Memory Police, which the Japanese writer in translation and English now for this past year, and it's set on an island where the authorities erase one by one entire categories of things. Roses, perfume, And as the concept disappears from the language, people start forgetting about it. But there are some people who remember, who always carry that trace of memory, and they need to be hidden, you know, Anne Frank style, and protected, because they're sort of like the keepers of the memory. And again, even though it was written in the past, it somehow is entirely resonant with our present.
I loved it too. I think that's a fabulous recommendation. It's chilling, but because of this past year, actually these past 4 years, nothing seems impossible. So
yes, exactly.
I'm getting a lot of good tips. I need acorns in my go bag, and I should definitely not forget roses. So I'm really enjoying this. What about nonfiction? Or do you guys have any recommendations about that?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead, Barbara.
Okay. So you probably might remember back in January, there was a great hue and cry about a book called American Dirt, which is fiction. I'm going to get around to nonfiction, because it was about people from Mexico seeking asylum in the U.S. and people who've been victimized by a drug cartel. And there was a great discussion because the woman who wrote the book was not Mexican. And that led to a lot of conversation about who gets to tell the story. And putting all that aside, because we could talk about that all night, what I set out to do, because we all have to acknowledge that the publishing industry does not publish enough authors of color, clearly. So I vowed to read more authors of color, fiction, nonfiction, the whole thing.
Right.
And one of the authors I came to, who I've just read and adored, is Gerald Walker, who wrote a collection of essays called How to Make a Slave. And this guy deals with being Black while shopping at Whole Foods, making a restaurant reservation and showing up Black, and what happens. He deals with living as a professor in a white college town, raising Black sons in a way that really sort of acknowledges the complexity of all of this, but it's not a polemic. It has a sense of humor, and he discusses things in a really accessible way and a really original way. I think he's a fabulous writer, and I think How to Make a Slave is a book I highly, highly recommend. The other nonfiction book is Natasha Trethewey. She's a Pulitzer Prize winning poet, and she wrote a book called Memorial, a stunning book that's a memoir about the murder of her mother by her stepfather. Her prose is poetic, and the way she describes what happened and how the history of our country plays into how her mother died is chilling, and you know how it's going to end, yet it's incredibly suspenseful. So Natasha Trethewey's Memorial is a book that is totally on my list. And then the last nonfiction book that I just loved this year, well, the last for the moment of this conversation, is Say Nothing by Patrick Radden Keefe, which is a story about the IRA in Ireland, with some real life, larger than life characters. And I must have been kind of, even though I'm old enough to have remembered a lot of this history, I missed a lot of it. And it's kind of confusing. And the best nonfiction to me is told in stories. And that's what Say Nothing is. So
I actually read that one too, and I found it really gripping. So,
Dolores worth the Price, time. Who knew?
Yes.
And Stephen Ray.
Exactly. Vanessa, what about you in the nonfiction category?
Sure. Yeah. So I loved Roberto Lovato's Unforgetting. It's also a memoir, but he grew up in San Francisco's Mission. His family is Salvadoran. But I mean, it's not just, it's a personal, but story, but it also looks at sort of the larger forces at play. I think so often there can be this desire to like see things, you know, American exceptionalism or things happen a certain way due to an individual. But Roberto just takes such a larger historical view, looks at the larger forces at play. It's gripping and really, really a great book. I also enjoy Bridget Quinn's She Votes. This year was the 100th anniversary of the suffragist movement. And so she writes in a really engaging conversational style. There were 100 pieces of art to go along with, you know, the 100 years. And so it's just a sort of like inspirational pick me up. And I mean, and Quinn doesn't sugarcoat the history. Like it was a long and difficult path. And certainly something, you know, seems is the sort of book that would, you know, vital reading for people of all ages. And then the last book is, I don't know if anyone's heard of Chinatown Pretty. It started off as an Instagram account by photographer Andrea Lowe and Valerie Liu. And basically there's this, they went to Chinatowns all over the place, including in the Bay Area. And the, you know, the stripes, the polka dots, the flamboyance, the neons, like all the ways that the grannies and grandpas dressed up is lovingly featured in the book. So again, something that can't help, you can't help but smile seeing the photos.
It is. I've seen that one too, and it's a great one. You cannot believe those combinations can go together of clothing, and yet they look pretty awesome. So,
yes, with extreme panache.
Extreme panache. Exactly. Well, tell me in our last few minutes, something I like to think about are books that are kind of guilty pleasures. Do you guys have anything like that on your list where, I mean, it doesn't have to be a Harlequin romance novel, but something that, you know, kind of fits the bill. What would you recommend, Barbara?
Well, before this year, I was not a big mystery fan. I came to this relatively late in life, and I'm not even going to call them guilty pleasures, because a well-written mystery is as valid as anything else I read. And I am by no means a highbrow person. I mean, you should see some of the TV I watch. It's like insane. But since I now love mysteries, I can recommend a couple of them.
Well, let's take one. What's your best one? Since we're
okay, I'm going to say Jennifer Ryan's The Spies of Shilling Lane. It's a World War II story, a very unlikely protagonist, an older kind of frumpy woman who just comes into her own in a beautiful way. And the World War II set in England, London during the Blitz, is just juicy, juicy, juicy.
Ooh, yum. And what about you, Vanessa?
So I don't consider this a guilty read at all, but I really, if you want something that's sort of like big and dishy and wealthy people getting a comeuppance and women in jail, and, you know, big pharma, I would recommend A.H. Kim's A Good Family. It already reads like a script, and there's, you know, it's a page turner and a lot of fun.
Well, that one is on my bedside table, so I'm going to pick it up right after this show. I want to thank you guys, Vanessa Waugh and Barbara Lane, our book Brain Trust. All these recommendations are going to be on our website. Thanks so much, ladies.
Thank you.
Yes. That's City Visions for this evening. Again, for the list of books we discussed tonight and a link to this and other City Visions shows, visit our page on KALW.org. Join us next week for a look at what the first 100 days of a Biden administration might look like with local Congressman Jared Huffman. Our engineer this evening was Dee Miner. Tonight's show was produced by Susie Britton and Kendrick Lang and features music by Gary Bartz, the now Bay Area-based legendary saxophonist. Thanks so much for listening. Good night and have a great evening. Stay safe.